Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Today's guest is Nicholas Crampton, the co-founder and chief architect behind Fourth Wave Wine, an Australian company that's cracked the code on how to reach consumers at all levels. Now, he started at corporate at what is now Treasury Wine Estates and then turned his redundancy payment into a new wine brand. Since then, Fourth Wave has embraced a trend-first, retail-ready playbook. He spots macro trends happening overseas and adapts them for shelves in Australia. He also negotiates hard with powerful Australian liquor chains. The company now has a portfolio of about 45 brands and sells more than 1.4 million dozen bottles annually, and all since 2009. In this conversation, Nick walks us through how he's built brands like Tread Softly and Elephant in the Room, why the company doesn't bother with consumer testing, and how they negotiate with giant retailers. So here's some background for non-Australians. You'll hear Nick talk about Endeavour Group, which is Australia's dominant liquor and hospitality platform. It operates the country's largest drinks retail network via Dan Murphy's, the flagship liquor chain, and BWS. And it also has a portfolio of hotels and brand and manufacturing businesses. Nick repeatedly refers to Dan Murphy's as Fourth Wave's number one export salesman, meaning the visual role their stores play in shaping perceptions of Australian wine abroad. He jokes that if you're the Aussie wine buyer for an international supermarket, your first stop is Dan's. Okay, so here's what you can take away from this episode. Deep insights in how to an upstart wine company succeeded by trend spotting, using wine quality and great design rather than vineyard pedigree, and just plenty of insights about business generally. Now, just a note about this recording. I did it on my laptop in an Australian bedroom that had extremely slow internet. If you just want the takeaways, they'll be in the Drinks Insider newsletter in November. You can sign up at drinksinsider.com. And if there's anybody or anything you want to hear featured on Drinks Insider, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. So I should have asked, Nicholas, do you prefer Nick or Nicholas?
I don't really mind. I've been called worse. I will take Nicholas.
So what's the worst you've been called?
Oh, I'm not telling you that.
All right. So your background is really interesting. You've worked in corporate wine, first at Southcore, and then what is now known as Treasury, which used to be called Foster's. So what did you learn from working in corporate wine that you're now applying at Fourth Wave?
Well, it is fair to be reminded that when I started in marketing at what was Southcorp, I knew nothing about marketing and learnt virtually everything from being there. There's learnt a lot of the things I don't do, but look, the main things would have been around not tinkering, endless label changes.
Really?
But also that if you want to run a big company, you need lots of parts working, things being delivered on time, etc. So I learned a huge amount at Foster's.
Did you have a wine background when you joined?
I was working in restaurants, so I was what you'd probably call an underqualified sommelier, but I became, became aware to them through running lots of events, so quite creative wine dinners and similar things. So it was pretty clear that my abilities lay not within tasting wine but doing interesting things with wine, which led me to a job in a tech company or like a e-tailer and then onto Foster's, or Southcorp as it was then.
So the first thing I can find out about you is that you launched Le Chat Noir. Was that while you were still at Treasury, or was that the thing that convinced you to go out on your own?
Yes. So, well, what convinced me to go on my own was I was made redundant.
Okay.
But then look, I mean, I had been working in marketing on Penfolds, and then I moved on to running the smaller wine companies for Southcorp. And what became apparent at the time was you can afford to miss a mega trend once, but you probably can't afford to miss two. So I was heavily involved in this sort of the trend watching. So as an example, Australian Chardonnay got basically decimated by Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. And, you know, companies that were very long-term companies basically saw their entire market dry up. Champagne at the time also did a huge amount of growth in Australia. So basically we were looking at what trends we felt or I felt could come next that we couldn't afford to not be part of. And a classic one that came after my time was rosé, which for many decades we said, oh, Australia doesn't sell rosé, we don't know why, and now it sure as heck does. One thing with the Europeans is they are still fixated by appellation, not brand, and not making things easy for the consumer. The reason why Spanish regions call Tempranillo different things, just to confuse people, the Italians are a bit the same. So for me, Australians, we had a very strong exchange rate. We were all traveling to Europe. We were loving Europe. But the brands that were sold here, we didn't understand the labels. They were often confusing. They were sealed with a cork we didn't like, and they weren't very attractive. So I saw a gap to launch a French brand that was easily understandable to Australians.
All right, so what year was this?
That was 2009. My wife had always wanted us to do our own business, and she was very instrumental in encouraging us to do so. And when I was made redundant, I have all the respect in the world for people who start businesses with 5 years of savings, hard-earned savings. In my case, the redundancy gave us a real impetus to start our own company. So that we started in 2009, and the first wine, Le Chanoir, Sauvignon Blanc and Pinot Noir arrived in December of 2009.
Just to go back a step, you said it's really important not to miss trends. So this is the big topic on everybody's mind. So how do you spot a trend that's coming up?
We talk in a number of ways. Well, to be honest, I'll answer that in two parts. To be honest, firstly, the majority of trends in the Australian wine industry and the beverage industry have either started in the UK or in the US. And so if you're watching, you know, I always talk about natural wine bars in Paris or corporate bars in in London or trendy double magnum drinking rosé bars on the beaches of the Hamptons. So that's excess, et cetera. You know, cider on ice, et cetera, et cetera. If you're watching around the world, you'll normally spot when a trend is starting. The skill for what we do is to understand when a trend becomes big enough, it isn't just being hand sold by a sommelier in a natural bar in, let's say, Paris to a captive audience. It is bought off a shelf. In the adoption curve, there's a fair moat between what you'll see in a trendy wine bar and what you'll see off a shelf. So that's what we look for. And to be honest, there are some retailers around the world with fantastic insights. In Australia, Endeavour Drinks, Dan Murphy's and BWS have a fabulous amount of insights, and we tend to go off, listen to their insights and then try to add our own value through creativity and insight.
Now, obviously, most companies don't go around giving out their insights. Is that because you're in partnership with them, or is that because they know you can create the new thing that they need?
Yeah, it's very... No, I believe that Endeavour came to the realisation that to get the most out of their supplier base, they had to help those suppliers with giving them the level of data they had. Obviously, one of the things in sales is it's really important that you and your customer both agree on things, in terms of insights. So rather than them holding their insights tightly and us guessing what their insights are, it's been far more useful for them to tell us what they're thinking, and then we go and try to add value. Because clearly, if everyone has the same insights, then you're not going to win by just giving them what they're asking for. You have to think about how you can do that better or add your own insights as well.
Okay, so say you're in the Hamptons and you can see that they're all drinking, I don't know, orange wine on ice. What do you do next with that insight? Do you build a brand? So when you decide to build a brand, what's your process?
Yeah, as you say, you're looking for a trend that might have mass appeal. We are increasingly understand our role. As an example, we are a more mainstream wine business. In the Australian market, wine that we sell below beneath $20 is where we sort of work. So if I'm seeing a trend somewhere that might be very premium or very niche, it might not just be for us. But then, yes, we're looking, we then, I guess it's like we weigh everything up. We weigh our ability to source that wine, make that wine, our ability to have it ranged, and then our eventual belief in the number of consumers who are going to buy that wine, or even the logic behind it, you know, because a lot of what we do is we take a boutique premium trend and try to give it mass appeal, and then we engage our designers.
Can you give me an example of where you've done that? So an example of where you've taken a premium trend.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think natural wine would be a great example where if you look at the purest essence of natural wine, you've got a handcrafted product being made in the back blocks of France, very small volumes, possibly a compelling style, sort of controversial style, not for everyone. Expensive, hard to find, etc. And you think, but you think about what is it about natural that was had the potential to engage or excite particularly younger consumers? And you can go through natural, and if you look at natural wine in Australia now, you might say, look, actually there hasn't been that much impact. But what it gave as an example was they were not afraid to break all the packaging rules. So a lot of the more modern, dynamic, fascinating packaging has been inspired by natural. Even if the end result is a lot less, more conventional, their packaging did that. Lower alcohol levels, picking riper and fresher. The entire Australian move into certain varietals like Grenache are now at 12.5%, 13% wines from Grenache when not many years ago, 14.5% with heavy oak was considered how you made Grenache, and now, you know, they inspired a generation. So, you know, you can continue. So the point is you can pull apart some of the underlying trends to work out why these things work, and that's what we try to do. And certainly now, as I said, you know, when you throw in sort of our casualisation of our dining, you're seeing the days of someone taking a – there'd be very, very few people who are taking a 10-year cellared bottle of Cabernet to a BYO Chinese restaurant or Japanese restaurant tonight. It's all lighter, fresher, earlier drinking styles. And much of that has flowed down to the mainstream wine market from the premium wine market.
It's interesting. So when you see something like this and you decide to create a brand, do you do any consumer testing? So how do you actually build the brand?
We do absolutely no consumer testing. We work with who I believe to be the greatest wine label designer in the world for Margaret Nolan, and then with Rowena Kalouis. And what I probably do is position the pricing, the style of wines, and then Margaret does something based on her long experience of what she thinks will work and engage a consumer. But certainly we do not do any testing.
Okay, so I'll go back to this question of how do you convince a retailer to take on the brand? Is that because they know you so well and they know it will work, or do you have to fight for shelf space like anybody else?
Well, we certainly fight for shelf space, and we win only a little bit more than we lose. But as I said, I think it's worth mentioning that, and I think you'll probably no doubt reference it later on, the wine industry is not in a particularly comfortable space right now. Probably the worst time for when I was doing what I do was during COVID, when with all the restaurants closed, retailers were booming. You know, they were growing at 25%. They didn't know what to do. They were more worried about how they filled the shelves than, you know, the category. Where now there's a bit of tension. You know, there might be varying 2 to 5% in decline. So they're looking for solutions. They're looking to reinvigorate their shelf. So you are coming to them with a compelling offering, with a logic behind it and a track record of working. So not everyone takes. I think at the moment we probably globally are pushing the brands that sell most successfully in Australia, because they're the ones we believe have the most chance of success. I often joke that Dan Murphy's is our number one export customer, export salesman, because if you're a wine buyer for an international supermarket chain and you come to Australia because you're the Australian buyer, you'll visit Dan Murphy's. And when you visit Dan Murphy's, you'll see that invariably our brands are through all their shelves looking fantastic. And our sort of mantra of making the shelf a more interesting place, a more relevant place where you might stop and pick something up, is proven in that case. So, it is good to move from a decade of selling based on your opinion to selling based on the facts of our sales. But clearly, we are always still rolling out and developing new wine brands that, you know, somewhere in the world on day one, there'll be the first case put on a shelf and then you see what happens.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was actually in Dan Murphy's yesterday and all of the fourth wave wines really jump off the shelf. The Tread Softly design is fantastic. You just want to reach out and pick it up, both in the cans and in the bottle format. All right, so when you launch a brand, what sort of volumes do you work with at launch?
Well, when you launch a brand, what kind of volumes? It depends on how you're launching. To be honest, you should always launch less than you think. We always get too optimistic. One thing we do try to do as we add value is do some of the harder to make things, whether that's zero preservative or organic or lower in alcohol or what are these. So you are having to put a stake in the ground and go, well, here's our forecast. Certainly, whilst we don't own a winery, we also don't buy bulk wine. If you're buying large volumes of bulk, your quality will not be really competitive. So we do a lot of wine done on wine supply agreements. And so pretty much I will make a bet on a number and hope like we can sell it. If not, it gets blended into our other, existing business.
And where's the wine made? Is it all bought as finished wine or do you make the wine yourself?
We would make about 10% of our wine ourselves. Again, carrying on to points we've made previously, the Australian wine industry has an oversupply issue, particularly in Cabernet Shiraz and Merlot at commercial price points, less so the things people want. So there's a lot of capacity out there, and there's also regional specialists. I am not good at finding 30 people in regional areas to grow grapes for me. So it's far better that a third, fourth generation family who specialise in grapes growing do that for me. And then we normally, people who have a large number of vineyards also own a winery and they like to fill their own winery. So the easiest model for us is to have a long-term wine supply agreement where wine is delivered to our specifications. Our winemaking team oversee the wine's being made, and then obviously we focus on the selling and the marketing. It's very common these days. You'll see, I understand at the premium price points, there's a romance in owning your vineyards, but at the big commercial end, superannuation funds around the world love owning fixed assets and will take a smaller return. So most big companies are selling their actual vineyard assets at commercial levels to companies that are happy to take that small but safe and steady return. So we're no different to anyone else, really. We just probably have it a bit more out there, I guess you might say.
Can you talk through how you conceive brands like Tread Softly and Elephant in the Room?
One thing with briefing a wine brand is most people will write down a whole lot of detail and data and lots of stuff. They'll have 10 pages of background, but they won't have a single compelling thought. So in my opinion, the best way to get something great from a designer is to just really give them a single point. Tread Softly was about being the next generation wine for the next generation female wine consumer. We were also heavily aware that probably from about 2010 in Australia, there's been an explosion in modern and contemporary and impactful labels covered in designs and colours and, very contemporary. But the issue, and it's probably most seen with the Arctic Blue bottle. When the Arctic Blue bottle came around, it stood out like a beacon against all this dark glass. But when everyone did the same bottle, then you had a wall of just bright glass. So we realised the shelf was getting very busy, and we felt with Tread Softly, the consumer, you might call a mindful consumer, who cared about the environment, cared about, you know, the future, wouldn't mind a beacon of calm on the shelf. So Tread Softly was a deceptively simple label that might not have worked on a very simple shelf, but it went onto a very busy shelf and just immediately connected. A brand like Tread Softly, though, was past that packaging then, sort of unveils layers of detail with naturally lighter and alcohol, and obviously like the tree planting of one tree per six pack, and now 3 million trees. So that was Tread Softly. Elephant in the Room was a bit earlier. Elephant was driven by a belief that I could see in the market that a lot of wine media talk one way when the consumer was talking the other way. So a lot of Australians really quite liked their full-bodied Chardonnay, and then they were told one day that Chablis Chardonnay was what they had to drink. So a lot of existing brands dropped their alcohol by one and a half, two degrees, and they went from being big and fat to being lean and mean without really asking anyone why you'd do that. So we were, the elephant in the room were being, the elephant in the room was that there was a, just a miss, there was a lack of connection between the influencers of the industry and the actual consumer. And we said, fashion zero, flavour 10, defiantly full flavoured. And I also believe that despite all the rules of winemakers that you could only grow Pinot Noir in cool climates, that we could make a beautifully light-bodied and approachable Pinot Noir from mainstream fruit. So we basically championed the belief you could do a good, a nice drinking Pinot Noir for less than $15, which we have done many, many cases since.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that came up when I was reading about your wines in the media is how many people, including wine critics, said the wine is really, really good. So I've spoken to lots of people on this podcast who think the brand is more important than the wine quality or the flavour. What do you think?
Oh, look, I mean, obviously, if there's any, if there's one rule in the whole of the wine industry, is do not take the consumer to be a fool. I remember back in the day, if you look at some of the sweet wines at the lower price points, no one would talk about them, but the people who bought these wines were buying them every day when I was at South Corp. So if you change the sugar level on one of these wines by 1 gram of sugar per bottle, these consumers knew. So you might tell me this person knows nothing about wine and he's drinking cask wine or whatever it is, but he or she absolutely knew what they liked and what they wanted to have. So we would never say a brand's more important than the wine. Our winemaker, Corey Ryan, has a very, very long career in, he was actually a head winemaker for Pinnacle, which is the Endeavour wine business. So he's done a lot of blending, and we're very, very focused that the label will get you your first bottle sold, but they have to like what's in the bottle. So for us, again, we're looking at a style that's consumer focused, that's approachable. It doesn't need to age 10 years. It doesn't need to have the oak or the whatever it is to win show medals. You know, we're making a wine that tastes great for the consumer, but certainly tasting around Europe, particularly less so than Australia, if you really chase the lowest price point, you will end up with a wine that is suboptimal. We believe our packaging allows us to charge a dollar more, and then a dollar more allows us to pay our growers well, pay our winemakers well, and deliver a good product to the consumer. And that sort of $1 more, £1 more mantra is what we're taking to the world.
All right. When is it time to let a brand die? And, you know, what steps do you take and go, okay, it's time to retire this brand?
When it stops selling? Yeah, look, I mean, people come at us and talk about life cycle on brands. I think it's the last thing they can have a go at is your brands won't have life cycle. And clearly the great brands will have a longer life cycle than the not great brands. What we would tend to find these days in a very actively moving shelf from an elite contemporary retailer is, you know, there's a new range review every year, and they'll be discussing with us opportunities, and we'll look at what we have ranged, and we may well offer up our lowest performing product to put a new exciting product in, or they'll make that decision for us. So really, you just see the numbers dwindling down. What I would say is that When you have a constant pipeline of innovation, you're excited by what's coming, you're less concerned about deleting your 1% or 2% less. So we're constantly watching for products that are not very big anymore or have no strategic benefit, and we will delete them happily because we know we're launching new things.
You've also talked about natural wine. The natural wine community is fiercely protective of natural wine. It's not typically a product that you can turn into something commercial, but you have. Did you get any pushback?
Not at all. I mean, at least not to us. The natural wines that we make are pretty natural, so we do try to follow those rules as much as we can. And, yeah, so don't, look, we... Where we would look, the thing about what we do is we are a retail-focused business, so the pushback we do get is that probably the trendiest boutique or trendiest natural wine bars in Sydney are not going to stock our products. Having said that, we don't bother going and seeing them because it wouldn't be a worthwhile call. But so that, yes, in venues where they control and curate their own lists, we're probably not the products for them. But I do believe in a retail setting, we are bringing a fairly genuine natural wine experience to that customer.
One of the things that's coming out really strongly in food research is that consumers want to know about ingredients. They want to know what's in what they're consuming. And of course, alcohol bottles don't have any ingredients at all on them. Is this something that you think is a weakness for wine, or is it something that wine people should start putting, you know, on their bottles, or is it just something that doesn't matter?
I think there's an overall impression that wine is a pretty natural product. It is my expectation that labelling requirements will continue to increase. We're seeing now in Australia we have to, you know, I think for the fifth year in a row, they're changing our back label specs soon, that we have to have calories on the back label. We've had various warnings. So, you know, as those requirements come, we will match them. My understanding is it's a fairly complex task for us. But, you know, I think anywhere there's transparency, it can't be a bad thing.
The other trend that's happening internationally is flavoured wines like Stella Rosa or XXL. Have you gone into that space, or would you?
Absolutely. And if you'd asked me that question 2 years ago, I would have said no. So we are just launching a major flavoured brand called Patisserie with our partners at Dan Murphy's and BWS. There is no doubt in the last couple of years the flavoured, particularly flavoured sparkling market, you would have seen no doubt that in Australia, the mighty Zoncello, nothing to do with me, sadly. Zoncello has absolutely brought flavoured wine through a very simple message, though. It's yellow, it's pretty cool, and it tastes sweet. So people, it's actually a really good product as well. So people could see what they're going to get, understood what they're going to get, and liked what they were getting, and guess what? They came back. So I think last year they were saying, you know, flavoured sparkling is now larger than champagne in Australia. So, again, you know, we have a little bit of that market, but what we're looking to try to do is bring those insights into the table wine segment, into table wine segment with our brand Patisserie.
Okay, so tell me about Patisserie.
Well, the thing that's really interesting for me is we will do wines that are so Patisserie is flavoured wine where you're looking to, when we started, you thought, You throw enough flavouring in, you can just dominate any you know, start with a neutral grape and just add flavour. And that really wasn't what we were trying to do. So pretty much in the end, you're looking at the natural flavour of a grape variety. Let's say that's passion fruit with Sauvignon Blanc. If you try to bomb that away by making it taste like mango, they really fight. So what we've done is accentuate that flavour and using, you know, front labelling to give the consumer an indication they're going to have a passion fruit tasting wine, subtle use of natural flavours, and then, you know, the playbook internationally of slightly sweet and slightly sparkling. So what you're getting, my ambition is you have a product that if somebody's walking the varietal shelf and doesn't twig that it's a flavoured product, they're still happy with what they get. A Chardonnay is a creme brulee Chardonnay, and the creme brulee Chardonnay really just accentuates that sort of decadence of 1990 style Chardonnays in a big sort of lovely drink. So for me, our best brands appeal to a wide audience. You might target a segment, but in general, if your brand is targeting the young, target the young and the young at heart. So for us, Patisserie is a beautiful pack of the most delicious wines out there. And we are on the shelf in a few weeks and we'll see how we go.
I guess going into flavourings is a completely different skill set. So when you're doing something like this, do you go to a flavour house or how do you develop it?
Yeah, look, and I should mention, as I mentioned before, our forever young winemaker, Corey Ryan, he just adopted the challenge of making it work. I mean, I think for us, the journey to flavoured wine possibly started a few years ago with the journey to low and no alcohol wines, where you, as a winemaker, you know, you're not, you have to improve what you're starting with. So yes, we absolutely went to a flavour house, and in 6 months of intense testing, there would be in Australia a number of flavour houses. And what was interesting for us was you might have, let's say you're working with five flavour houses and they all have access to different flavours, but they're not all equally as strong as the others. So we ended up sourcing the best particular flavours from one flavour house and the best particular from other flavour houses. And definitely drawing on the knowledge of, you know, the bottling experts and the RTD and other category experts to make a product that really ideally, you know, still maintains the aspiration of wine but gives the flavour profile that this consumer who's not a core wine consumer enjoys.
Another trend that's beginning to emerge is the high-strength wine. Are you seeing that?
Yes. Yes, so we did a brand called Mullet with a defiantly hard Shiraz and hard Cabernet, high alcohols. It's just about personal. Number one, it's about personal choice, and number two is don't generalise that everyone is the same and all looking for the same. Health and wellbeing means different things to different people, and some people aren't interested in health and wellbeing at all. So for us, it gets back to, I hope if you buy a Mullet wine that says hard Shiraz and 17% on the label, you're expecting a big, powerful red wine. If you buy a brand called Tread Softly that says naturally lighter in alcohol, you're expecting and you get a more elegant flavour. So with each thing we do, we try to make the packaging and the overall brand give an indication of what you'll get and if that's what you're looking for. And look, to be honest, you can talk to your friends who are regular wine drinkers but not particularly experts, and one will tell you, he goes and buys the one with the oldest vintage on the label, and the next guy will tell you, turns around and finds the highest alcohol. So however they want to join the wine game, that's what we do. But certainly for us, the high alcohol wines are working. They are working. Mullet was targeting younger consumers, and we're finding it is definitely attracting people to the category who weren't purchasing before.
On this podcast, I talk to a lot of people in the North American market, and a number of them have said that one of the reasons that things are so bad over there is because the distribution bottleneck means that consumers only really have a small number of wines available to them, and those wines are not really distinguishable from one another's on the retailer's shelf. Mm. And also that all the interesting wines through premiumization have moved out of that $12 to $20 range where you're sitting. What do you think about that? And do you think the $12 to $20 range is actually where the opportunity is?
I think everyone else should move out of 12 to 20 and leave me to it, please. That would be fantastic. What I don't want to do is have wine disappear up its, you know, up and up so that wine becomes only drunk on special occasions. For us, I can understand, you'd have to understand the economics of the big corporate, buy $1 billion winery, buy $2 billion wineries, and then sell lots of premium wine. With, I assume there's higher margins for them. But for us, that's not a game. I don't have billions of dollars lying around, you can imagine. So I will leave that to them, and we will defiantly fight that we can make wine you can drink every day. You know, we are actively looking at all the reasons for why people are moving away from wine and trying to find solutions that solve that. As an example, we've just launched our recent brand Bento, which is, you know, we've seen in Australia now casual dining and Asian dining, fast-paced, energetic, you know, loud dining with shared plates really is what is popular with Australians to eat, and it does not suit premium heavy red wine. So we made a brand that was very much about versatile, pure-flavoured wine that was They're actually all no added sugar. We just got there from a point. These weren't going to be sweet. Those are going to be really versatile wines. And again, the package just encourages you to think, oh, I'm going to an Asian restaurant. This might suit. So we're trying to take back every occasion we can. And and just to follow your point, I completely disagree that you can't make good wine. This sort of talk that you can't make a good wine for less than $20 or it's all commercial. There are bad examples of commercial wine around the world, I agree, but we're trying to do the opposite of that because we think at that price we can make very nice wine people are very happy with, particularly for, you know, everyday and casual occasions.
You mentioned that people are turning away from wine, which they absolutely are. So what do you think some of the reasons are?
Well, I guess it goes country by country, but, you know, the decline, people seem to make out that small percentage declines are incredible doom and gloom when they are relatively small. But we just also think that people now have a lot. Look, so there's obviously, we can go through, I'm trying to think of the, you know, in the Australian market as an example, we can see that people are settling down. There's historically, you get into wine when you coupled up and moved out of home. So if with housing affordability being so hot, so bad in Australia, you're living at home for longer, it probably means you then socialise outside your home because you don't want to be with your mum and dad. If you socialise outside your home, it's probably standing up, which tends to other categories rather than wine. I also think the cocktail culture's done a wonderful job and people can have a real involvement in what they think is a built cocktail as opposed to a mysterious bottle of wine. You know, so we have to accept, I think other categories have done very well in Australia and wine's now trying to, I guess, combat that. Health and wellbeing clearly is a massive factor. People are drinking less or certainly being conscious of their drinking during the week, etc. So I think, again, wine just has to respond to various trends. But I think when we are showing signs of doing that, we're seeing results.
And how do you respond to young people? What's the solution to them drinking less?
Well, increasingly flavoured sparklings in small format bottles. You know, we've done a 330ml wine spritzer at 3.5% alcohol that, you know, they really like. On the more depressing note, in a way, I'm going to tell you the story anyway. We have the number one wine in a can in Tread Softly Prosecco, and it's a beautiful can and it has flowers all over it. It looks very sustainable, but we have been told a lot of people are drinking it because it is 10% alcohol, which is low for a wine but high for an RTD. So I was a bit sad about that. I thought it was for better reasons. But if you give them the right product, they will consume it, yeah.
Interesting. It's interesting, of all the objections, that's not one I would have thought about. I would have thought maybe people thought aluminium is less sustainable than glass, which is what people often say. All right, so what do you see ahead in terms of trends?
Well, you try to differentiate between what is a trend and what is an underlying shift. I don't think health and wellbeing is going anywhere for quite a while. I don't think casual dining will be changing anytime soon. I think in general consumers, I don't know, show my age here, but when I got into wine and got into restaurants in Sydney, it was all white tablecloth and holding your elbows in and lovely stemware, and everyone was told they had to own decanters and a wine rack and all of that stuff just is not, and you were quite intimidated. You had to follow the rules of how, you know, let's say the French drank wine, where I think much more confident younger consumers are just, they're dictating their own rules. So they're not wanting to be intimidated by that sort of stuff. So I think all the casualisation of wine, the format changes, alcohol levels in wine and definitely flavours in wine that make it both easy to understand and secondly, easy to appreciate as a wine style will just continue to go and go. We'll continue looking at how we can tap into broader cuisines and how the cuisines are eaten, but clearly short of extremely spicy foods that I don't know what you eat or drink with them, we'll be looking at anywhere we're told we can't sell wine.
And I should ask you, how many cases have you done now since you started in 2009?
So we're 1.4 4 million dozen annually, of which about 1.1 million is in Australia. But our growth now is equal parts export to Australia. So our growth in export would be 60%, or about 200,000 cases of growth last year, and about the same in Australia.
1.4 million. That's amazing. All right, that's the end of my questions, and I want to thank you so much for talking this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Very nice to talk to you.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.